Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. With all the noise and distraction around us today, some are putting their dreams and goals on hold, and that's not a good feeling. Others are attempting to plow through but not being successful. And I know that based on conversations with friends and colleagues and the large number of emails I've received from listeners, that this chaos around us right now is making it very hard for many of us to focus on anything. Well, today's guest is an expert in the field of life purpose, meaning, the creative life, and getting things done. He's Dr. Eric Maisel. He's joined us before. He's the author of more than 50 books in the areas of critical psychology, writing, creativity, and the creative life. And he's talking with us today about his new book, The Power of Daily Practice, How Creative and Performing Artists and Everyone Else Can Finally Meet Their Goals. So we're going to talk today with Dr. Maisel about what daily practice means and what it looks like. And it's probably not what you think right off the bat. We explore the psychological and practical benefits of daily practice, look at some of the 20 elements he identifies to make your practice successful, and of course, we look at some of the challenges. So again, here's my guest, Dr. Eric Maisel, and his book, The Power of Daily Practice. Dr. Eric Maisel, welcome back to Conversations Live.
Lovely to be back. Thank you for having me.
I can't believe how prolific you are. Is this book number 50, I think?
Well, it's probably crossed 50, and I think I've sort of stopped counting, but yes.
Well, we've talked before, obviously, and about other books you've written, and I know you have several specialized interests around creativity, the creative life, life purpose, mental health, but I don't think I've ever asked you how you first became involved in creativity, because you've done so much great work around it. What drove you there?
Well, I guess I'll give you the long answer. I started out as a science boy. I went to a math and science high school. I thought I would be a physicist, but science wasn't human enough for me. It didn't really interest me. I liked big numbers, like how far away stars were, but I wasn't really interested in science, so I quite naturally flunked out of college, joined the Army. When I got out of the Army, I got a degree in philosophy, which is one of those things you do when you have no idea what you're doing.
Right.
And to make this long story short, I had always loved reading, of course. One falls in love with reading. I'd loved both fiction and nonfiction, and I started my first novel when I was 24. I had a ghostwriting career through my 20s. I actually made a living as a writer, which was quite amazing. And I kept writing fiction, but then we started having a family, and it wasn't quite authentic enough, honorable enough to keep doing that when it wasn't making enough money. So I retooled and became a therapist, a California licensed therapist, but I didn't believe in the therapy model pretty quickly. I was working with creative and performing artists. Those were my clients. I wanted to see them, but I didn't believe they had mental disorders. I believe they had the challenges I've been writing about for the last 50 years.
Mm.
And so I segued from doing therapy to doing what I first called consulting, because there wasn't a thing called coaching back then. We're talking about the 90s. And then when coaching became a popular word, I moved from creativity consulting to creativity coaching. But I have always loved reading books, what words can do, loved the masters of the language, loved also those writers who would explain how language can be misused, the Orwells of the world who explain what we need to be knowing right now in our political sphere about how language can corrupt us and harm us.
Yeah.
So at any rate, I've been interested in books and writing my whole life. I had a small visual arts career also. There was a time when I did pastels and had little shows of pastels and what have you. So I've been all around the ballpark, but basically it's been words and then wanting to help folks who toil in these fields.
Interesting, very interesting. And so on your website, you say you specialize in what's known as critical psychiatry and anti-psychiatry.
Yep.
Is that what you referred to just when you said you didn't favor the models that are typically used?
Precisely. There are three ways of saying the area I'm in. It's either critical psychology, critical psychiatry, or anti-psychiatry. Nobody in that universe agrees as to what to call ourselves, but the main thing is we object to the mental disorder model. We think it's actually basically fraudulent. We think that a kid who has a lot of energy and who's bored in school and is bouncing off the walls doesn't have this mental disorder called ADHD. He's bored and bouncing off the walls, and he shouldn't be given chemicals with powerful effects.
Right.
Called incorrectly medication. They're not medication, they're just chemicals with power. We can sedate anybody. We could hit you with a tranquilizer dart and put you down. That doesn't mean that we're actually medicating an illness that we can identify. So we could spend hours and hours on this because it's really a travesty and a tragedy what's going on with respect to everything from clinical depression to PTSD to bipolar to kids' mental disorders like ADHD.
Right, right. I see it and I agree with a lot of what you're saying there. Another day, we'll have to have you back another day to talk about that because it's one of my pet peeves, actually. But so let's focus on your book right now, The Power of Daily Practice, because this is a phenomenal book, I think, and so timely, Eric, with everything that's going on in the world right now. It's called The Power of Daily Practice, How Creative and Performing Artists and Everyone Else Can Finally Meet Their Goals. So why did you want to write this book?
Well, I've been thinking about and looking at the issues of creative performing artists for a very long time, and each time I look at it, there's something else interesting to say from my point of view, whether it's about creativity and depression, creativity and anxiety, creativity and addiction. But on a practical level, on a tactical level, on a technical level, when I work with a creative or performing artist, almost always the main thing is getting the work done, whether it's practicing the guitar or writing your novel or whatever it is, it's getting the work done. You can't really be successful if you're not getting the work done. So it would be putting the cart before the horse to talk about being successful before we talk about actually having a good habit in place of getting the work done. And it's not just that missing a day here or there would be so terrible. It wouldn't be. If you worked 5 days out of 7 days on your novel, that would be spectacular. The problem is that when you skip a day or two, you start losing weeks, months, and years. That's the big headline. If I were to summarize the point of the book in one sentence, it's that if you don't have a daily practice, you lose years.
Mm.
And that's what people experience. They experience putting their novel away for a year, or not getting back to their diet for a year, or not working on their mindfulness practice for a year. Without that habit in place, without that daily practice commitment, we just don't get to our life purposes. We don't get to the things that are important to us. And that's pretty much everybody's experience, that they're not getting to the things that are important to us. They're pulled about by the nose by their daily to-do list. And yes, they get a million things done. Everyone's getting a million things done, just not what they actually want to get done.
Right. And I think it's important here to say that this is not just for creatives. It's for anybody, whether you're a business practice, a spiritual practice, an activist practice, because, you know, we automatically jump to that creativity practice, which, you know, I need to definitely instill in my world. But this really applies across the board, whatever your purpose is and your meaning are.
That's
meaning
right.
is.
And I describe, I think, maybe somewhere between 15 and 20 different practices that one might want to create and maintain. So, yes, because I'm known to create and performing artists, we wanted to aim the book at them, but really it is a book for everyone. And I think many people would apply a different adjective in front of practice, maybe mindfulness or yoga practice, or a lot of people have a practice in place or would like to have a practice in place that isn't a creativity practice. But there are lots of other practices apart from yoga practice or mindfulness practice or writing practice, things like a health practice or a mental health practice or a business building practice. those are things that people typically don't institute, and they really ought to, because it would make a difference in their life.
A big difference, because the common saying is, if you're a small, especially a small business owner, if you're working, you know, in the business, you're not working on the business, so that daily practice would account for that.
That's right. But just parenthetically, when I work with creative and performing artists, I ask them, which means I demand it. I ask them to do three things in the service of their business every day. They don't want to. Most creative folks don't want to work on the business side of their business. They want to write their novel. They don't want to be tweeting or whatever. That isn't what they want to be doing, but we have to do that. With this new book out, I have a list of 10 things I do every day in support of the book. You can bet that I'd rather be doing something else than those 10 things. But that's why it needs to be a practice, because if it weren't a practice, who would get to these things?
Right.
It would feel like drudgery. They wouldn't feel meaningful. They would feel repetitive. There's no reason we know why you should be doing it, but you wouldn't be doing it by virtue of how unpleasant it feels to do it. That's why just knowing that from whatever it is, 6 a.m. to 7 a.m., you're going to do X, well, then even if on a given day you can't quite do X, or you can only do it for 3 minutes, you still won't have lost momentum. You won't have done that thing I was talking about earlier of disconnecting from the thing and losing years. Maybe you'll only do a half-decent job on that day, but basically you'll still remain in touch with the thing you're trying to do.
Yeah. So let's look what a practice might look like, because there's no one-size-fit-all. You're not regimenting, you know, a structure here. It doesn't have to be the same time, same place every day. So talk to us a little bit about what a practice might look like.
As you say, it could be anything. And by the way, sometimes it has to be a regular practice as opposed to a daily practice. Let's say, for instance, that you're a divorced parent and you have the kids 3 days a week and your mate has the kids 4 days a week. Well, maybe there are good reasons why you can only do your practice on the days when the kids aren't with you. Maybe it's too chaotic the other days. So although I'm saying daily practice, I more mean a very regular practice, something that you can, so to speak, count on. What I describe in the book is the idea that a solid practice is made up of a certain number of elements. I go through 20 of them. I wouldn't dare try to go through them with you on the phone. We'd lose every listener.
No. I picked out a couple that I'd like to look at.
But the basic idea is that there are certain qualities to a solid practice, and one of the main ones is just to keep it simple. Most people, when they try to set up a practice and then add all sorts of details, rather than saying I'm writing today, they'll say I'm writing 1,060 words today, or I'm writing for 32 minutes, or and add more bells and whistles and end up tiring themselves out even before they've started. So I think a solid practice rests on simplicity, obviously on regularity, and also on honesty. Our whole life rests on honesty, but I think we need to be honest about whether we're really doing the practice. Are we paying attention? Are we really present? Are we thinking about other things and not, even though we say we're doing our practice, are we thinking about other things? So there are lots of elements to a solid practice, and I think all of them, all of these 20 elements, combine together really in a very straightforward way. When you read the book, you get it. You get that this is what a practice looks like, and it can be 20 minutes. By the way, when I work with a new client and I ask that client, how much time do you want to commit to your novel or your painting or your whatever? Almost always, I could bet you a nickel on this, the client is going to say 20 minutes. And the reason I think they pick such a small number is they don't want to disappoint themselves. They don't want to say, well, I'll spend 2 hours on my novel, because they know they won't or can't to begin with.
Right.
And so they say a small number, and that's why I absolutely recommend whatever practice we're talking about, whether it's a recovery practice or a mental health practice or an activism practice, you don't have to set the bar super high to begin with. You just want to show up each day. Set it at 5 minutes. Were you to start to do X for 5 minutes every day, that would grow past 5 minutes pretty soon, and you wouldn't lose touch with it. You would really get it done.
Yes, and so one of the biggest benefits I see, especially right now, is that there's so much uncertainty in the world, so much distraction and disruption, that establishing a regular practice is really a gift to ourselves to escape that, if nothing else.
Yes.
And because it's something we have control over too.
Yeah, and in my language, I'll say a kind of long sentence here. I believe that we need to identify our life purposes in the plural, make choices about what's important to us. I don't think there is a purpose to life. I think there are life purpose choices. We can start each day with a life purpose check-in, where we sort of look at our list of life purposes, remind ourselves what's important to us, and then negotiate the day around those life purposes. So maybe we have two or three or four practices during the day. Maybe we start with our creativity practice because that makes use of our sleep thinking, so that ought to go first in the day. But then maybe we have a relationship practice where we gather ourselves up to have that hard conversation with our daughter about her drinking or something. And we have some other kind of practice in the day also. By negotiating our day that way, by organizing our day that carefully, I think we do a better job of surviving these particular chaotic times. We've calmed ourselves down and provided structure and order where otherwise there would be chaos.
Yes, and it's certainly a more productive way of spending our time than...
And a more peaceful way, I think, actually. It may sound boring, but actually boring is not the way it ends up feeling. It ends up feeling right.
Yeah.
It ends up feeling like you're doing the next right thing, one right thing after another, which is a good feeling, and that makes us proud to feel like we're doing the next right thing.
Hmm. Can we talk about rituals or ceremonies, as you call them, as being one of the elements you talk about as daily practice? And I remember reading years ago choreographer Twyla Tharp's book, The Creative Habit, and she said she rises at 5:30 a.m. every morning, and the cab arrives outside her New York apartment, and the second she steps into her cab to take her to the gym, which you would think is a ritual, but the second she steps into the cab is the beginning of her ritual. That's the beginning of her daily practice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's exactly it. There's no difference between entering the cab and entering the cab. They're both the same physical action. But if you treat one more ceremonially, more seriously, more solemnly, whatever word you like there, then it becomes something different. It becomes, I call it initiation as one of the elements of daily practice. It's the way you start your daily practice. One of the ones I suggest, and I've suggested it in whole books, I did a book on this called 10 Zen Seconds, and the 10 of the title is one long breath, 5 seconds on the inhale, 5 seconds on the exhale. One ceremony I suggest is bridging between everyday life and your practice by engaging in a little deep breathing and right thinking. Just drop a useful thought into a deep breath. So let's say you're meaning to start writing your novel. The thought might be ready to go. And you just breathe in and breathe out a few times and say ready on the inhale and to go on the exhale a few times. There's not much to that, except it's very valuable because it's calming you down. It's quieting all of those monkey mind thoughts, and it's getting you ready to actually begin to work on your novel. So that kind of ceremonial bridge, I call them incantations, which is really just, it's an affirmation in a breath. Those incantations, I think, are kind of excellent ceremonial bridges in and also out of your practice.
Yes, definitely. And I know that's something that helps me. I actually had to separate desks, if you will, because I work on so many different projects, and I don't like clutter and chaos. But I found separating my desks, you know, made such a difference, because when I sit at one desk, I'm in this frame of mind. When I sit at the other desk, I know I've got to work on ABC, whatever it is.
Yes, and so many people do have to organize their space before they can have a successful practice. I was surprised by that. I guess I thought people were better set up in their own homes than they actually are, but it turns out that most people do need to organize their space better. They can't really write their novel at the dining room table with three kids running around. They have to figure out how to create time, of course, but how to create proper space of this work.
I mean, is that to do with changing your state, changing your mental mindset between the roles that you play?
That, and I think it's also we have thoughts preying on us that don't nervous about that we're in the middle of chaos, that we're in the middle of a mess.
Right.
You know, if you try to write your novel on your desk and there are 1,000 other papers there and bills to be paid and what have you, you can kind of push that all aside and work on your novel, but you're still brooding about all that stuff on your... You're disappointed in yourself by the fact that you haven't made a good space for yourself. And I think, just parenthetically, this is kind of a non sequitur, but I think a lot of people are disappointed in themselves right now for not having done more while sequestered. You know, an awful lot of people got more time on their hands.
I've heard that.
And kind of thought that maybe they could do X, Y, or Z during that time. Finally, I don't know, learn Russian or write their novel or do their yoga practice or whatever, the things that they always thought they wanted to do, and they're not doing it because they can't, because their thoughts aren't serving them, basically, because they're too uncalm to be doing these things right now, the things they want to do. I think it's a particularly poignant moment, this moment, where folks doubly need the idea of daily practice so that they don't disappoint themselves by not using this, so to speak, free time.
Yes, and I'm guilty of that, just like the next person. I've talked with many people, Eric, who've said the same thing, and even really successful people who've said, I just can't concentrate. And someone I know who regularly reads 2 books a week, he said, I haven't even read a chapter. He said, I keep reading the same darn page over and over again.
That's exactly right. Well, you know, in the political realm, so many of us are so troubled with, like, triple underlines, so troubled by what's going on, that alone, forget about COVID, that alone would keep people on edge between now and the election and, you know, thereafter if things go poorly. So that alone has been enough. And then the virus and lots of other things simultaneously going on. Here, where I am in Northern California, it's hundreds and hundreds of wildfires. How are you supposed to sit down and just sort of calmly, you know, paint your painting or go out and take a photograph in the middle of all of this?
Yeah.
That's why having the practice, I'm of course repeating myself, but that's why having the practice in place can help, not just a little, but a lot, in allowing us to continue to live our life purposes, even in the middle of these really troubling times.
Yes, I think the book is, I mean, it's so timely. I know you didn't time it for this particular time, but it's so timely that it's come out right now. I want to talk a little about seriousness and lightness. I remember my dad always telling me when I used to work with him as a teenager, you know, don't take yourself too seriously, but take your work seriously, meaning if I was going to do something, do it to the best of my ability. And you also talk about lightness and how we have to find that balance between seriousness and lightness.
I think you just said it beautifully. I think I would just repeat what you said. But let me add a little bit. I've recently developed a whole philosophy of life I called Kierism, and there's a book out on that called Lighting the Way. If that happens to interest folks, that's the place to go learn about it, in the book called Lighting the Way. And one of the elements, one of the ideas in Kierism is the idea of absurd rebellion. And that is that, you know, here we are, you and I, absurdly trying to put the whole world on our shoulders, trying to do good work, trying to keep civilization afloat. That's crazy. That's absurd to think that we should have identified ourselves as the ones to keep civilization afloat, and yet each moral person does that, makes decisions along those lines about how important his or her efforts are. Well, we take that seriously, but at the same time, we have to hold that lightly because it is absurd. It's absurd to think that we can do that much about what's going on. And I think when you combine that seriousness with that sense of lightness, you have the, so to speak, perfect practice. There is a way to combine those two things. Maybe another way to say it, and I think you said it sort of like this a moment ago, the way to say it is to show up but not attach to outcomes. And that's very important, that distinction, that we're doing the practice not to get somewhere, but because we can't get somewhere if we don't do it.
Right, right.
And I think part of the restlessness that we experience in our daily practice, if we do experience restlessness, is this felt sense of not making progress. Here I am playing the same chord again for the millionth time. Oh, my God, is that what I'm doing? I'm not getting anywhere. Or I'm working on my novel and I'm kicking out 50 words rather than putting in 50 words. That's progress. And we have that metaphor built into us very strongly, the idea that we're supposed to be making progress. That's, in fact, the reigning metaphor of the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, the idea of the upward spiral, making progress. Well, our practice is not about that. Our practice is about being there and doing the work. If we make progress, wonderful. That's a blessing. And of course, over time, if we don't make progress, it's going to be hard to keep at it. But we can't judge each session by how much progress we've made. That's another aspect of lightness, is to not be judging each session, each practice time, and trying to figure out if it was worth it or not. That we showed up is the thing to celebrate.
Interesting. And so then if we fall off track, which, you know, being humans, we probably will, we get back on track as quickly as possible and don't judge ourselves and just...
It's that two-part thing. You've said the second part of it, which is get back as quickly as possible. The first part is forgive yourself as quickly as is humanly possible.
Hmm.
We need way more self-forgiveness. And I think we sometimes play a little game with ourselves where we don't forgive ourselves because we don't actually want to do the work. So we stay self-disappointed as a way of not getting the work done. We're very tricky creatures, human beings.
We are. I run into a lot of writers, obviously, in my world, and I hear, you know, would-be writers, but they don't want to sit down and do the work. They just want that book to appear.
They'll say the things every human being says nowadays. I'm busy. I'm tired. And because there are so many grains of truth in all of our excuses, there are so many grains of truth that we let ourselves off the hook. And we have to, another habit to put into place is appending a big but there, a big B-U-T. Yeah, I'm tired, but I can work on my novel for 20 minutes. Or, yeah, I'm busy, but I can paint for half an hour. If we don't append that but, then we just let ourselves off the hook and we disappoint ourselves and we don't get our work done.
Mm. Can we talk a little about perfectionism? It's not one of your elements, but I think it ties into a lot of what you talk about. It's something I definitely battled over the years and still do to some extent, although I do understand it a little better now. But I've seen it absolutely cripple people physically, creatively, emotionally, to the point where it's really detrimental. And they just stop taking any kind of risk, even though that risk could be a big game changer for them.
Yeah, I tend to reframe it as anxiety, perfectionism, because whether it's a perfect reframe or not, by reframing it as anxiety, then you can turn to anxiety management tools as the way to deal with it. I do think it's a face of anxiety, and I think it's the anxiety of being judged, being criticized. To be sure, the work isn't out there yet, but we're predicting that when it gets out there, people will notice that we put the comma in the wrong place or something. That's the perfectionistic anxiety, is the anxiety about being judged. And all kinds of things that go with being judged, namely loss of self-esteem, loss of love, lots of different kinds of losses come with being judged. So I would say that perfectionism is an anxiety state, and if one agrees, then the response is to have an anxiety management tool that works. Most people just try to white-knuckle anxiety. They don't have anything to do apart from having more scotch or something, but apart from doing the things that are unsatisfactory or unhealthy, apart from that, most people don't have anxiety management strategies that work.
Right.
I go through 20 different categories of anxiety management strategies in one of my books called Mastering Creative Anxiety. There are lots of things for folks to try. And I think that's another place of authenticity. Being honest with ourselves is to admit that we get anxious, embrace the fact that anxiety is going to thread through the process forever till the end of time, and put it on our shoulders to come up with some anxiety management strategies, at least one, that actually works for us.
That makes perfect sense to me, the way you just expressed that. I think maybe we let ourselves off the hook a little when we say we're perfectionists.
I think so. I think it's another tricky, cute human tactic.
Right. Right. Well, you talk about challenges in the book, and I know we're running out of time here. I could talk to you forever, but I want to ask you what your biggest challenges are in your daily practice.
Oh, I'm not sure that I dare say that I don't really have challenges.
Do you know, I thought you were going to say that. Because we've talked before.
I guess, you know, I have as an element of practice completion, so I'm going to sort of play a funny game here and say that my challenge is stopping.
Okay.
that actually is my challenge, especially with these days where it's too long to say why I have so much time on my hands, but I do. And I noticed that after 7 hours of working straight or 8 hours of working straight, I still want to continue doing these things that interest me. So for me, I really don't have trouble with daily practice. My only trouble is managing to stop before I get too exhausted.
Right. And I think maybe that's the key to your success, because you love what you do. And I was looking at a project. One of your challenges in the book that you talk about is boredom. And I was really struggling with this project. It's a personal project, so nobody cares if it's done or not. And I was like, why am I struggling with this? Because I was really hot on it when I began it. And it's because things had changed and it no longer really meant anything to me.
Yep. And Virginia Woolf said we start with enthusiasm and then resignation. Resignation sets in.
Right.
And I think it's partly boredom, but it's partly that sense of resignation. Oh, my God, I've got this whole thing to do. I had it done in my head in a split second. That was easy.
Right.
Now I have to actually expand it into a whole thing. Oh, my God. So, yeah, that's exactly right. And whether it's boredom or all the difficulties combine to make it easy to not want to do it.
Well, I could talk to you for hours. As I said, the book is called The Power of Daily Practice: How Creative and Performing Artists and Everyone Else Can Finally Meet Their Goals. I know listeners can find out much more about you, Eric, at your website, ericmazel.com. Final thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Just that this is a big deal. It's easy for this to go in one ear and out the other. Oh, daily practice, of course. Who wouldn't want that? But I think if you are trying to live your life purposes, this is about the only way to do it, is to live them on a daily basis.
Well, Dr. Eric Mazel, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.